I next met with Dr. Richard Stone, and to begin, we discussed one of the great challenges in oncology, the patient with AML.
Acute myeloid leukemia, or AML, is really a heterogeneous group of myeloid stem cell neoplasms, which, if unchecked, will cause terminal bone marrow failure and lead to the death of the patient. So we certainly want to think of ways to optimize therapy. Current therapies are very toxic and resource intense, and we'd like to be able to apply the right therapy to the right patient, as is the case with any neoplasm these days. Basically, when I think about AML, I first think about two big things. Does the patient have acute promyelocytic leukemia, or APL, which accounts for about 15% of all AMLs? Or do they have any other type of AML? Because the treatment of APL is completely different and highly successful. And if we have time, we can talk about that. But for the other 85% of AMLs, then I start to think about a few things. Three things, to be exact. One, what's the patient's age? Two, what's the patient's chromosomes? Three, in many cases, what's the patient's BLAS genetic mutations? And I'll come back to what I mean by that in a second. Finally, and additionally, I also think about the patient as a human being, what their other medical problems are, what their philosophy of life is. But let's talk about disease-related features for a second. What do I really need to know about the AML specifically? Yes, I'd like to know the FAB or WHO histologic subtype. But what I really care about are the chromosomes at the time of diagnosis, and in the case of people with normal chromosomes, I'd like to know certain genetic features. Let me come back to that. So for younger adults with AML, that is to say patients between age 18 and 60, pretty much, again, for the non-APLs, they're all going to be treated the same way initially, with 3 days of an anthracycline, usually daunorubicin, and 7 days of cytarabine. Hopefully that's going to put them in remission. Remission, of course, means a leukemia-free state, as best we can detect. We cannot detect reliably small amounts of leukemia, but we know inevitably that the patient still has small amounts of leukemia when they're in a morphological remission. And once that occurs, we'd like to know whether we should do a chemotherapy-based approach, which could potentially include an autologous transplant, although we don't do those very much anymore, or should we do an allogeneic transplant using a donor, which would either be a patient's sibling or a good unrelated match, and in some cases, possibly even what we call an alternative donor transplant, which would be using cord stem cells or possibly a haploidentical donor, which means a half-matched donor. So basically, if we're going to give everybody so-called 3 and 7, 3 days of daunorubicin or another anthracycline plus 7 days of cytarabine, and we're going to do allo transplants on some of the people and not on others, it becomes crucial to know who can get away with a chemotherapy-based approach and who requires the very toxic and resource-intense allogeneic stem cell transplant. And so there we come back to the disease biology. And for people under age 60, there's 3 subtypes based on chromosomes. About 15% have what I would call favorable prognosis chromosomes, which means either an inversion of chromosome 16 or a translocation between chromosome 8 and 21. Both of these chromosomal subtypes involve translocations of genes which encode for members of the core binding factor transcriptional apparatus. So that's 15%. Another 15% have what we call adverse chromosomal abnormalities. These are the types of chromosomal abnormalities we see with myelodysplastic syndrome or with treatment-related AML. We're talking about complex chromosomes, which means more than 3 abnormalities, or abnormalities of chromosome 5 and or 7. So for the patients with a good prognosis cytogenetics, we're going to use chemotherapy-based approach for most of them because they'll do well and don't have to subject them to the dangers of an allogeneic transplant. For those with the definitively poor chromosomes, we're going to do an allogeneic transplant from whatever donor we can find. What about the 70% of the other ones who have intermediate chromosomes? Most of those have normal chromosomes, and the big advances over the past few years have been parsing that subgroup down into different subgroups based on the genetics at the time of diagnosis. And while there are about 30 genes which are known to be recurrently mutated in AML, at this moment in time, we just care about 2 of those genes for the most part, maybe 3, but mostly 2. And that would be the FLT3 gene and the NPM1 gene.
What kinds of numbers do you have in your head or, you know, that you give to patients in terms of the chance of cure with both situations?
So let's take the older first, because if you just look at the sum total of older adults with AML, the cure rate with chemotherapy-based approaches is only 10% or less. And I think it's very important to try to transmit that in a compassionate way to the older adult with leukemia, because many of them, when they hear that, really aren't willing to take the prolonged hospitalization and risks involved with induction chemotherapy and maybe with allogeneic stem cell transplant. With allogeneic stem cell transplant, if you look at all patients in remission, the cure rate is as high as 30%. So it looks like 30% for an allogeneic transplanted patient versus 10% with a chemotherapy-treated patient who's older. There's never been a randomized trial comparing those two approaches, so it's a little bit shakier ground than the numbers I'm going to give you for the younger patients.
What about ablative versus non-ablative allo?
Well, an older adult, which is what I've just been speaking about, we don't do the ablative, really, because it's too dangerous. So those remarks for older adults pertain only to a non-myeloablative allo. I'll come back to that issue because it's important. In younger adults under age 55 to 60, the cure rate overall is about 40%. And, of course, this is where the rubber meets the road vis-a-vis the allogeneic transplant versus chemotherapy controversy. The cure rate's probably a little bit higher overall if you apply the algorithm I mentioned earlier that is transplanting almost everybody except for the really favorable ones. The cure rate in the aggregate is probably going to be a little bit higher, but there isn't really any good, and there probably never will be any prospective trials to prove that beyond the shadow of a doubt. But I think most of the trials that are available do suggest that transplant's a little bit better.
And what numbers do you have in your mind or maybe that you give to patients in terms of the mortality rate of treatment with allo, either in the younger or older patient?
Great question. The mortality rate with an allogeneic transplant with a full, so-called full myeloablative transplant for somebody under age 55 is in the 10 to 20% range. The mortality rate for an older adult undergoing a non-myeloablative transplant is in the 10 to 14% range, that neighborhood. It's clearly lower, not dramatically so, but clearly lower. But people can still fail transplant due to relapse. Generally speaking, I think of myeloablative transplants as being associated with about a 20% relapse rate, and with non-myeloablative transplants being associated with about a 40% relapse rate. So what I said a few minutes ago was I'm going to get back to this issue. For people between age 50 and 65, or 50 and 60, who could reasonably get a non-myeloablative or a myeloablative transplant, it's very difficult to know what to do. Most transplant doctors will do a myeloablative transplant in a patient they think is relatively fit, especially if they have a situation where the risk of relapse is high, for example, second complete remission or bad chromosomes. They'll take the added risk of the myeloablative to get that maybe a little bit greater anti-leukemic effect.
For the older patient who, you know, for example, is over 75, 80, certainly there are people out there like that, what are some of the questions that you think come up in their care and how do you answer them?
How to treat people over 75 with AML is a very tricky area because there is no standard approach. I've actually seen the gamut from purely supportive care, which is not uncommon, all the way to allogeneic transplant, even though I said we don't do them at Dana-Farber. I have a patient that I consult on who was 78 when he had an allogeneic transplant at UMass Worcester. So there's a spectrum, but I think you really have to match the treatment to the patient's needs and wants. It's nigh unto impossible to cure somebody who's over age 75. So it's very hard in my mind, at least, to justify the use of induction chemotherapy routinely in those patients. I would say I give induction chemotherapy, the 3 and 7 that everybody's familiar with, to people over age 75, maybe 2 or 3 times a year, which means I do it in about probably 10% of my patients at most who are of this age group. And the reason is you can't cure them, so why subject them to this toxicity? You can palliate them, and we're studying this in more detail, with lower dose options. You know, there's, when I talked to a person of that age, I said, you know, basically you have 3 ways to go. We can go no dose, low dose, or high dose. High dose meaning the 3 and 7 induction, which I indicate is not going to be associated with a cure rate probably, but maybe a 40% remission rate. Some people want to go into remission because they know that's going to be associated with some quality of life for a while. Some people say, you know, I've lived a good life. I don't want to do anything right now. Just give me transfusions. And I think most want something done. And those are the people that we typically give what I call low dose therapy, which in Europe is low dose ARA-C, which has been around for a long time. in America nowadays is really either 5-azacitidine or decitabine, neither one of which I hasten to point out are approved for use in AML in this age category. In fact, there was a randomized trial of decitabine versus either low-dose Ara-C or best supportive care done largely in Europe called the DACO-16 trial, which really didn't meet its primary endpoint, although it did meet a survival benefit in an endpoint that wasn't a planned analysis. This trial was taken to ODAC. ODAC turned it down in a fairly close vote. Despite that, decitabine, since it's approved for MDS and it's out there, is used by many people to treat AML. A lot of people don't think that was the right decision, but anyway.
So earlier you mentioned APL, and I'm always curious to hear the latest in that disease. What's new in terms of upfront management without chemotherapy?
Yeah, this is critical, actually. I just emailed a doctor from Florida about this today who had an APL patient down there, and I told him what I do now for intermediate and low-risk disease, and it's all you have to remember is the white count. White count greater than 10,000, that's high-risk disease. At diagnosis, white count less than 10,000, that's either intermediate or low risk. It doesn't really matter. Anyway, because of the seminal work done by Francesco Lococo and colleagues, mainly in Italy but also in Germany, published late spring or early summer in the New England Journal of Medicine, I think the standard care has changed for people with white counts less than 10,000 of APML, which is 2/3 or more. And that's simply to use all transretinoic acid plus arsenic trioxide without chemotherapy. So this is a chemotherapy-free approach. And because it was a randomized trial between that and something called the Pathema regimen, the results were as good and actually better with a chemotherapy-free approach. So I have changed my practice in those patients. And in the people who have higher risk disease, that is white counts greater than 10,000, I'll either use the so-called CLGB 9710 regimen, which is 3 and 7 plus retinoic acid for induction and then arsenic for early consolidation, and then some more anthracycline and Atra for late consolidation. You could also just add gemtuzumab ozogamicin if you can get your hands on it to Atra arsenic. That's a bit out there for high-risk patients. Basically, the bottom line is Atra arsenic.
So your aforementioned colleague, Dr. Kantarjian, has been something I've been chatting with him about for years, and for a long time now, he's been telling me, and he continues to say that he has concerns that there are people who are slipping through the cracks, quote, so to speak, in the beginning and dying of this disease without getting access. And I'm curious, how often do you think that happens?
Well, this was actually studied by the French in the Marseille area. They presented an abstract at ASH, which I thought was very interesting, where they tried to see if they could institute a policy where people in their community would be able to rapidly get access to Atra, which is what you need to do because that takes care of the coagulopathy fairly rapidly. And they showed that they did institute Atra, but basically the biology was so strong that if they sort of the people were going to die, kind of were going to die anyway, although I still think it's a good idea to recognize the disease. The most common call I get from lawyers is delay in diagnosis of APML.
Wow. And what is your best guess or the best guess about the number of new cases per year and the number of deaths in those new cases per year?
So that's a good question, too. Mathematically, there aren't too many new cases. There's about 15,000 annually of AML. About 15% of those are APL. So we're talking 2,000 to 3,000 cases. Not that many. We have 50 states, so you can see there's, you know, not going to be that many in any one doctor's hands. So the toxic death rate, though, in the recent trials is about 5%, 10%. It really depends on, you know, if you're on a trial, you already haven't died, like if you're good enough to get to a trial. So it's hard to know. And I have a colleague in Georgia who's interested in community oncology who wants to do a project to see if he can sort of outreach the community. I think it's very important to try to make people aware of it, to slap them on the retinoic acid as soon as you think about it. You know, it doesn't cost you anything in terms of ultimate therapies.
Let's talk a little bit about MDS. You've put together this classic clinical scenario, 71-year-old man with pancytopenia, bone marrow shows MDS, 12% blast, complex chromosomes, including 5Q. So how do you sort of think through this clinical scenario?
Right. So I like to put this case in when I'm talking to community oncologists because of a couple of things. First, this brief scenario includes, quote, everything you need to know, unquote, from an international prognostic scoring system standpoint to determine prognosis. It's poor. I mean, the patient has a lot of blasts, has a complex karyotype, and has pancytopenia. I didn't go into the details of the pancytopenia, but let's just say it's profound. So their median survival is poor. We're talking 8 months median survival of a patient like this. So can we change that with therapy? The answer is yes, and I'll come back to that. But before I mention that, I want to talk about lenalidomide. Lenalidomide, every reasonably trained oncologist knows now that lenalidomide is approved for use in MDS. And they know it's approved for use in MDS for people with 5q- chromosomal abnormalities. And so this patient has that. So should we use lenalidomide? Well, the answer is no, because it's only approved for people with low and intermediate 1 risk MDS. That was a seminal trial that was led by Alan List in Tampa. It was for people that had any type of chromosomal abnormality, including 5q-, but they couldn't have this many blasts or they couldn't be high risk to go on. So we don't know if lenalidomide works in this situation.
What about transplant in MDS?
I think one of the big debates in MDS is whether a patient like this, if they somehow have a young sibling or a very common HLA type who's a match, you know, a match unrelated donor, should they go right to transplant? Because there's data suggesting that people who have higher risk MDS, intermediate 2 and high risk, this is data from Cutler, from my institution, and Deeg from University of Washington, Seattle, that suggests, based on modeling, that people that have higher risk MDS like this should go right to transplant. The truth be told, with a patient of this age group, most transplant physicians won't, quote, take them right away, unquote, because they're concerned about the too many blasts in the setting of a non-myeloablative allogeneic transplant, which is the only option for these patients. So they'll say, okay, get the patient's blast count down with azacitidine, and if that works, I'll take them to transplant. So then you're talking about a selected patient population. There's no prospective data that's really good that I'm aware of that suggests that's a good idea, but that's what's being done in the real world. If you want to get a patient like this to a potentially curative allogeneic transplant, prove that they respond to azacitidine or possibly to cytidine first.
So if this patient were low or intermediate risk, would you use lenalidomide? How would you use it? Any pitfalls in using it?
Of course, that would be a different case, but if they were lower intermediate risk, say they had 2% blasts, I would use lenalidomide because that's a little easier. It's oral. The response rate in terms of transfusion independence, if that was the patient's major problem, is about 60% in the intermediate 1 and low-risk MDS patients who have a 5q- abnormality. And at least in the initial trial, it didn't seem to matter if you had a 5q- as a sole abnormality or you had a 5q- plus other things. Although, again, in the fine print, there weren't that many patients who really had complex chromosomes because a lot of them would have been higher risk and wouldn't have been eligible. Anyway, if you would have been eligible for that trial, a lenalidomide trial, then you should go on lenalidomide because that's effective therapy. And as I said, about 60% have a reduction in their transfusional needs, which is important. And about 30 to 50% have an improvement in their chromosomes. Now, improvement in their chromosomes is not necessarily, you know, going to make you healthier. That's a surrogate marker, but it probably indicates a very powerful response.
So I do want to get your thoughts on some issues related to myelofibrosis. Can you talk about sort of your algorithm for management and where ruxolitinib fits in?
Sure. So anybody that has a clinical problem that could be addressed with ruxolitinib, I will consider that at the Dana-Farber. Of course, we have some clinical trials with some other agents, but a JAK2 inhibitor should be considered in patients who have symptomatic splenomegaly or constitutional symptoms that are bothering them. For those patients who just have anemia, it's less clear whether a JAK2 inhibitor such as ruxolitinib, which is the only one you could use, you know, off clinical trial today, is effective. So the good news is more than 50% of patients who have either symptomatic splenomegaly or who have symptomatic constitutional symptoms will be improved with the institution of a JAK2 inhibitor, i.e. ruxolitinib, right now. And there's some concern about worsening of the anemia, of the thrombocytopenia. It turns out if you lower the dose a little bit, if they're more anemic, you can get away with that, and people tend to have less problems with anemia over time with ruxolitinib than they did in the beginning. So it's a good drug. Not a great drug, but it's a good first start to make people feel better. The things you have to watch out for are the cytopenias, which I mentioned. Usually those are transient. And if you have to stop it, then I've seen some really nasty things happening with the so-called rebound phenomenon, but you kind of stuck with that. I would not start it because I was afraid about that happening if I stopped it, but you just have to be aware of that.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that issue because I was just kind of curious. You know, we know that patients often will have rapid improvement in symptoms, and you might think, and I guess I've seen data that literally objectively shows that within a few days of treatment, the symptoms come back. Just because you're taking away the brakes that's being put on or whatever, you're inhibiting it. So is there more involved than just quickly going back, you know, return to symptomatology? Is there something beyond that in terms of, I don't know, hemodynamic instability or other issues?
If you've had a nice response to ruxolitinib and you stop it, you can get basically a cytokine storm. I've seen that in a couple of patients, and that can cause hemodynamic instability right there.
But again, is it just, you know, sort of going the opposite direction that they came in? You know, they quickly get better, then you stop it. It's a static type effect.
Yeah, hard to know about the kinetics of it, but certainly my notion is, it may be wrong, is that you've got these cytokines that you're inhibiting with a JAK, probably because it's a JAK1 inhibitor as well as a JAK2 inhibitor. You're inhibiting the cytokines from coming out. And, you know, the receptors are ready to go. I mean, they're not seeing the cytokines, so they're upregulating the receptors. So, you know, the system is ready to respond in a very aggressive fashion once you stop it.
So I want to ask you more about JAK inhibition, but just to divert back out, you mentioned the patient who's more primarily anemic and maybe not very much in the way of symptoms from the spleen or cytokines. Other than, you know, supportive care transfusions, how do you approach those patients and where do IMIDs fit in?
Yeah, it's a great question. I do use IMIDs for those kind of patients. Teferi and colleagues at Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota have done some work with various IMIDs, thalidomide and prednisone on the one hand, lenalidomide on the other hand, and pomalidomide even, with steroids on the third hand, if there are three hands. And there are, I would say, a reproducible but not high anemia response rate of about 20% if you look at the really small data on this. So if a patient's having anemia but their spleen isn't bothering them and they're not, you know, feeling crappy except when they're anemic, then I would consider lenalidomide for those patients cautiously, especially if their platelet count is okay, because the lenalidomide can do a number on the platelets. So if it's also low, you're in a bit of a bind.
So sort of globally, I know you've treated a lot of patients. Most docs in practice, we found by survey, of course, have not treated very many patients. And, you know, if you have a more classic situation, the patient's got splenomegaly, they're having symptoms from that, they're having anorexia, et cetera, what's the likelihood that when they come back a week after starting ruxolitinib, they're going to say, I feel better?
It's pretty high. I mean, their published response rates, and I've been involved with a lot of other of the JAK2 inhibitors in clinical trials, so I haven't used ruxolitinib that much myself. But the published data suggests that it's going to be at least a 50% response rate fairly quickly, and then that's durable in many patients. I've certainly seen that in my patients that I've used other experimental JAK2 inhibitors with.
So a couple of practical questions. Incidentally, I should mention before, I wanted to talk a little bit about how to dose the drug, but would it surprise you if I told you that at least as of, you know, last fall, let's say a year after the approval of ruxolitinib, there were a substantial number of general oncologists that we were able to measure around 40% who were not aware that patients without JAK mutations clinically benefit from JAK inhibition?
Well, that's an interesting point. It gets to a larger issue of how one communicates. I mean, that's the business you're in, and it's a wonderful thing you're doing to try to get the message out there that the approval is based on myelofibrosis, not on JAK. Just when we taught people to only use EGFR inhibitors in lung cancer with EGFR mutations, you know, with lung cancer that have EGFR mutations mainly, we tell them it's not based on the mutation in myelofibrosis, and everybody knows about, everybody understands imatinib, nilotinib, dasatinib, bosutinib, and ponatinib in CML. Why, you know, why aren't we just looking at JAK2? And it's a complicated issue because even the myelofibrosis scientists don't really understand precisely the pathophysiological role of JAK2 in myelofibrosis. Simply, if you have a JAK2 mutation, why do some people get myelofibrosis and some people get PV or ET? So there's a lot of basic science that has to be done to explain this. And even though when Gary Gilland and many others around the world about 10, 12 years ago figured out that JAK2 mutations were ubiquitous in PV and common in ET and MF, and at that point, everybody got really excited and said, oh, we got another target. Let's make a JAK2 inhibitor. And that's great. That's the way it should be done. But, you know, clinical science is clinical science. And, you know, the fact that they were smart to let people go on the trial who had JAK2 wild-type disease. And, you know, it may just be that the other JAKs are fortuitously in this inflammatory pathway, which, I mean, if you look at, again, going back to the data I mentioned before with thalidomide and prednisone or pomalidomide and prednisone, it might be that the responses that were seen in those trials were mainly due to the steroids. steroids were used in the past and still are used for some people with myelofibrosis, and although they have deleterious side effects, they do work to make people feel better. And in a cynic's world, you might say that ruxolitinib is an expensive steroid. I don't believe that. But, you know, this part of this anti-inflammatory thing is important to think about. And why doctors don't get it. I mean, I really feel for the oncologists in the community. They're bombarded with all these things. You know, we're talking about a rare disease like myelofibrosis. They're dealing with colon cancer. They have a, you know, should they treat them with cetuximab if they have a RAS mutation? Should they not? They get a member of that.
So final question is, I'm just kind of curious to what extent, in terms of moving forward in myelofibrosis, what do we know about sort of cross-resistance among JAK inhibitors? Have there been clear-cut responses observed?
We don't know much about it. Some of the newer JAK2 inhibitor trials allow people, they have to because they won't get anybody on, to go on if they've seen ruxolitinib, for example. And I think we should certainly watch ASH this year to see some of that data. My guess is because each one seems to inhibit a different spectrum of the JAK2 family, there may be some non-cross resistance. I think where we're going, though, is very important, is that we've made some strides in this disease, maybe even affected the natural history in terms of survival, if you believe the retrospective data, but we have a long way to go. And the way to the future, again, just like in MDS, will probably be combinational therapy. And one of the prime drugs to combine with a JAK2 inhibitor will be a histone deacetylase inhibitor. There's been some data published by my colleague Dan D'Angelo and others that show that HDAC inhibitors do have a role, or do have some activity, I should say, in myelofibrosis. So just like we've done in oncology for years, if we've got two drugs that work in one disease but have different mechanisms of action or presumed mechanisms of action, combine them if you can do it safely and see what you get. So I think HDAC inhibitors plus JAK2 inhibitors are going to be a very important future, as will IMiDs plus JAK2 inhibitors as well.
What about using JAK inhibitors prior to transplant to, you know, shrink the spleen down?
Well, if you're going to do a transplant, you certainly want the patient in a cytokine better state and with a spleen better state. I mean, we actually used to, when we did transplants for myelofibrosis, take the spleen out routinely. We don't do that anymore because we found that hasn't been too successful based on a lot of prospective data, but it seems not to be too successful. So there's really no data. There's even less data about using ruxolitinib or other drugs like that to get a patient, quote, ready, unquote, for a transplant than there is for using azacitidine or decitabine to do that for an MDS patient with 10 to 12% blast. Having said that, you know, if you're really going to transplant somebody because they're anemic and they have cytokine symptoms and they have a big spleen, if you can get them through ruxolitinib, it probably wouldn't be a bad idea and get them in a better state if they're really sick, because you don't want to take somebody to transplant if they're sick, and ruxolitinib can make them better for a while.
So let's finish out talking about CML. You've been involved in that part of the field for a long time. Where are we today with now 5 agents approved in this disease?
Absolutely. Well, CML has probably been the disease that I have been most excited about through my oncological career, because Brian Druker, who was really the father of tyrosine kinase inhibitor therapy, is a friend of mine and was a fellow with me at Dana-Farber in 1984. So that's just a personal thing. But it's also been very rewarding to treat patients with CML who used to routinely require transplant, some of whom died with a transplant. Now we really transplant people with a CML because of the effectiveness of the TKI. So now using TKI therapy is a bit of a art and science. There are 5 agents that are approved for CML now. And so the big questions that come, what do we use for a newly diagnosed CML patient? What do we use for somebody who's failed imatinib? And where do we put ponatinib in the equation? So I'll hit each of those quickly. In the interest of time, upfront therapy, controversial. There's been 3 trials comparing imatinib, the old favorite, to the what I will call second generational drugs, dasatinib, nilotinib, and bosutinib. Both dasatinib and nilotinib, when compared head to head to imatinib, seemed to be a bit better, but that was using the endpoint of molecular or cytogenetic response at 1 year. Is that a good surrogate for long term outcome? Probably, but there's no certainty about that. So there was a so-called decision trial comparing dasatinib to imatinib that was showed dasatinib to be a bit better. Same for nilotinib compared to imatinib. The nilotinib trial showed a statistically significant reduction in something that would be considered a good thing to reduce, which is the transformation to accelerated phase of blast crisis. So you can make an argument to use nilotinib. Now, bosutinib versus imatinib wasn't positive, so we don't use that up front, although that was probably just a trial design issue. Anyway, so should we use nilotinib or dasatinib routinely up front? And I think it's an easier question now than it will be in a few years. Why do I say that? Well, you could certainly use for a young patient, you could certainly just say, well, look, those two trials were better. Let's just use what seems to be a little bit better. The side effects aren't bad. If you're likely to get a pleural effusion, don't use dasatinib. If you don't like the idea of not eating food before and after the nilotinib, you don't like a twice-a-day drug, don't use dasatinib. Or if you're older and the long-term response is that important, imatinib's fine. We know the side effect profile. Well, I say it's going to get harder in a few years if imatinib, God willing, goes off patent and these darn drugs are cheaper. That drug, at least, will be cheaper. I think you'd make a very strong case from a patriotic standpoint to use imatinib. The responses are great, and you can rescue most of the people who fail, or at least half the people who fail imatinib with nilotinib or dasatinib. So, I mean, right now, I do start most patients on nilotinib or dasatinib, depending on what I think their side effect profile is likely to be. Bosutinib is probably the best tolerated agent if you can get through the initial diarrhea. So if a patient's been on imatinib and they haven't seen dasatinib, nilotinib, or bosutinib, I'll consider those three as second-line agents. And it really depends, again, on the side effect profile. Bosutinib's once a day. Diarrhea is a problem, but it usually goes away within a month. Nilotinib, again, twice a day. Food issues. And dasatinib, pleural effusion issues, but it's just once a day and food's not an issue. So it's kind of like whatever you feel like in the second-line therapy if they failed imatinib. Finally, ponatinib, a very potent tyrosine kinase inhibitor, which has been approved for use in failed patients. Generally, that would be considered a third-line agent. If you failed dasatinib or bosutinib or nilotinib, you've got nowhere to turn except for ponatinib. And of course, if this is extremely important, if you've got a T315I mutation, it's the only drug that works. So that's going to be the answer every time right now. T315I, whatever point you make that diagnosis, and you should do that if the patient's not responding well to whatever they're using now, put them on ponatinib. The dose of ponatinib, the starting dose is 45 milligrams daily. That may be a bit high for a lot of patients. It has a lot of side effects. They get weird pains. They get GI side effects. It's definitely the toughest drug to take, even though it's the most effective in terms of potency. I should say it's the most potent. There is an important trial going on now called the PACE trial of ponatinib, so we can find out if this very potent TKI will ablate the need for switching to another TKI, because if you can take care of the nastiest mutation in the beginning, before it gets to be a problem, you might be ahead of the game.
Is ponatinib being compared to nilotinib or dasatinib?
Not to my knowledge in a randomized trial, no.
So
probably somebody's doing that, but I just don't know about it.
Then, I mean, I don't know how long it's going to take for the PACE trial to report, but I could maybe envision a situation where you might have to do some indirect comparisons.
I think there'll be a lot of transitive property of oncology comparisons done in the future, that's right. But I think if the PACE trial is positive, there'll be an issue about what to do with ponatinib failures, because presumably nothing else will work in that situation, so that'll be a little tricky.
Any comment about monitoring patients with CML?
The guidelines changed recently, and one part of the guideline I do agree with, which is that if you've been in molecular remission for 2 years, you can move from doing PCR checks in the blood from every 3 months to every 6 months. That saves a lot of money and agony on the part of patients. I'm fine with that. The one that's a little bit more controversial is the use of the three-month PCR to affect therapy. Many places around the world, including Hammersmith Hospital in London, a paper by Marin et al. That I think was important in JCO a couple of years ago, if you've got a high PCR, you know, again, it depends on the exact cutoff, but if you get a high PCR test at 3 months, you're not going to do well in the long term. You're more likely to go into accelerated phase and blast crisis. The question is what to do about that. And the NCCN guideline group, of which I'm not on in CML, decided to say, look, if you've got a high PCR test at 3 months, even if you're otherwise doing okay, you should switch to a second generational TKI. It's not unreasonable, but it's just not based on a lot of data.
Any comments about the issue of stopping treatment first, just the whole idea of whether it can be done in select situations? And second, an issue Doug Smith brought up on the last issue of this series, and he actually presented a woman from his practice who he had treated successfully who wanted to stop treatment and become pregnant. What about that scenario?
Right. So the only time I'm really bringing it up to a patient and say we should stop it, assuming they're not having side effects, is when they want to get pregnant. I actually had a very interesting case of a physician who saw me with CML the other day, a male physician, who said, can I father a child when I'm taking whatever I'm taking? I guess he was taking dasatinib. And the answer is really no, you're not supposed to, because we don't have enough good data, although the data for fathers has been pretty encouraging for lack of birth defects. For females, they have to stop it. There's really some concern that they may be teratogenic in females, so I would definitely tell a patient, a woman who's on it, to stop it. We can put them on interferon, or if they're molecularly negative for a while, we can just watch them off therapy. Which brings me to the main question about who we can stop it in. Well, you know, the famous STIP trial, stop-imatinib trial done by the French, you know, suggested that if you're molecularly negative for 2 years and you stop imatinib, most people will do fine. Either they'll remain molecularly negative for the duration of the follow-up in that study, which was a year or two, or they'll relapse with a molecular, you know, disease, but then they can go right back into molecular remission if the tyrosine kinase inhibitor, in this case imatinib, is restarted. Having said that, I think we need a lot more data before we can really stop it routinely, even in people who are long-term molecularly negative. I mean, if they're doing well, you know, why shoot a singing bird? I don't stop it. You know, if they're having side effects and they're really doing well, I might consider it there. There's a stop nilotinib trial, which we're involved in. So if they're on nilotinib, they're doing well, they can stop it in the context of a clinical trial. Obviously, that's fair game. Outside the context of a clinical trial, I really don't encourage people to stop a nilotinib or dasatinib or bosutinib or imatinib.